Zerita v. Hyde, 091165. Mr. Flesh?
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel. May it please the Court. A decisive argument for Chief Biang and Mayor Hyde is that the plaintiffs failed to prove that either of these two public officials violated a clearly established First Amendment right. With regard to Mayor Hyde, the key date is the City Council meeting of January 20th, 2004. At that City Council meeting, when Plaintiff Sarita rose to speak, Mayor Hyde admonished him. Now, 2 days before, there was an altercation or a confrontation between Sarita and city employee Susanna Figueroa.
Right, and we're very familiar with it, but certainly Mr. Hyde intended to stop Mr. Sarita from speaking at the January 20th meeting. He wanted that apology. He went into this long thing about offending, you know, a woman and all these other things. So he basically shut him down and said, unless you apologize, essentially you can't speak.
I agree with that fact.
So,
but
it was a public hearing.
It was a public forum. We agree with that fact, too.
Mm-hmm.
However, the context in which he acted is extremely important here, because Mr. Sarita contends that Mr. Hyde admonished him because Sarita had criticized a city employee, Susanna Figueroa, had told her at 2 days before the meeting that you're not doing enough for your people. Those are his words, not mine. Now, the cases, particularly Collinson, which is a Fourth Circuit case, and this court's opinion in Hansen from the early 90s, says that in these types of situations where you have a parliamentary ad hoc decision and you have a public official that does something, the question is, why is he doing something? The question is he attempting to suppress speech? That's the key First Amendment inquiry. Those cases take as the most important factor to look at as to how the public official treated the expression of what I'll refer to as the plaintiff's viewpoint by others.
Are you suggesting the mayor did not care about what was said?
Correct.
To the employee?
Correct. Absolutely. And here's how we know that. Because at the very same meeting, minutes before Mr. Sarita rose during audience time, another member of the audience, a Reverend Martinez, spoke at audience time and told Mayor Hyde that Susanna Figueroa should be fired, a much harsher criticism than Sarita's criticism. That was made at the same public meeting, and what did Mayor Hyde do? He took no punitive action against Reverend Martinez, although it was the exact same or a similar, if not harsher, viewpoint expressed. In fact, he acted cooperatively, and he told the Reverend, he said, well, please come up and talk to me about that. In addition, there were other people to criticize the city employees, as they have been for some 20 years while the mayor was in public office, and he never, there's nothing in the record that he ever took any negative action. Now, I am arguing right now to say that you don't have the violation. They didn't prove the violation of a clearly established constitutional right, because the cases to that point would have informed Mayor Hyde that the courts look at how you treat the reaction to the viewpoint in particular and other people expressing that viewpoint. Well, here you have Reverend Martinez expressing the same or harsher viewpoint, and Mayor Hyde took no punitive action.
Well, he focused really on how she was treated as a woman, and attempting to defend her honor, while might have been noble, doesn't constitute a compelling government interest, does it?
Well, We certainly didn't argue that it did, so I won't argue here that it is. However, here's what I will argue, that the time, place, manner rubric, which the plaintiffs use, that was not pled in their complaint, this is pure and simple a retaliation case. It has all the when I say retaliation, of course, I mean alleged retaliation. In this case, time, place, and manner was only advanced by the plaintiffs later in the case as a theory, which I concede they had the right to do, even though it wasn't pled in the complaint, as a theory because they couldn't find anything in terms of a retaliatory animus. But here's the key point for this argument, is that nothing would have informed Mayor Hyde when he acted that this ad hoc parliamentary decision would have been analyzed under time, place, and manner. There are no cases. The only case that they cite that deals with this is time, place, and manner, as opposed to the straight retaliatory alleged retaliation, is a case from the district court in Pennsylvania, the Wilkinson case. There, the court did deal with it under time, place, and manner, but the defendant also argued time, place, and manner. In this court, well, not in this court, in the district court, the Hardy case, the district court, when the parties below started to argue time, place, and manner, he said, well, it's a retaliation case. That's how we'll deal with it.
Well, see, you're saying that Hyde is entitled to qualified immunity, right?
Yes.
And if we accept your argument, wouldn't we be setting a precedent that if a government official reasonably believed that someone previously broke the law, because this was all about what happened 2 days ago, that an official is justified in later taking away that person's right to free speech?
No, I don't think we're arguing for any kind of a principle like that, because
well,
this is a
unique. Would that be the impact or the import of our decision that it would be okay? That, you know, the public official thinks something illegal happened at some point in the past. A person gets up to speak. Public official wants the person to make an apology or fall on the sword or whatever. And wouldn't we be legitimizing that conduct or saying that was appropriate?
Well, cases are decided on facts.
Right, but I'm saying facts similar to this.
I think what you have to focus on is the motive. And I think if the motive of the public official under the undisputed facts is that he acted for a reason other than to suppress the viewpoint or the speech. When I say the speech, I mean really the viewpoint. Then yes, then I think that that public official would be granted qualified immunity. Because if he acted because someone acted illegally before and it's not tied to a viewpoint, that's the question. I guess the key is always tied to a viewpoint. Here there is substantial evidence. This is an unusual case. There's a mountain of evidence that Mayor Hyde did not act based on a retaliatory viewpoint, that he retaliated against Sarita. He allowed Sarita to speak against the towing ordinance against employees in 2003. The answer to your question is that you have to look at the evidence to see whether there is evidence that he acted for another reason. And under the case law, this is almost a laboratory experiment because you have him addressing someone else who expressed the identical viewpoint that he is alleged not to have been tolerant of. So that is the answer to your question, I believe.
Is there some basis that you're looking at if this is a case of first impression, that this wasn't clearly established, that precedent, what the mayor did, therefore he didn't have obligation to know this, or they couldn't do what he did, or is it obvious that he should have known?
I think the answer to that is yes, if you want to focus on the question concerning that if there is a past or an illegality that a public official is presented with, and can that public official then say, well, you did something illegal, therefore, I can't admonish you based today as of now. The answer to your question is yes, because if it's viewed in that view, in that light, there is no case. They don't cite any case like that. So the mayor would have been then acting within the scope of legal uncertainty, and within that scope, he is entitled to qualified immunity because he does get, as the cases say, the benefit of the doubt. Let me, if I may, move on to Chief Biang. Chief Biang acted as he did. It's in the record. There's no dispute. Because he was concerned with the activities of the towing ordinance protesters themselves. He was concerned, based on the information that he had received, that the ordinance protesters could become violent or otherwise disrupt the public safety and welfare.
So you're talking about September 4th?
Well, I was actually talking about now. It's September 4th and July 6th. There's more facts on of 2004, that city council.
Sticking with the 4th,
yes,
just for a minute.
Yes.
Did Biang know that the outdoor assembly ordinance did not apply to Blank's planned September 4th rally at the park?
Did he know?
Because we're operating under different rules. You agree with that at the park.
Yes, the park. Did he know about the?
Did he know that the outdoor assembly ordinance that covered the park didn't apply to Mr. Blank's planned September 4th rally at the park?
Well, I'm not sure of that. I will tell you that the ordinance, I believe, says that you have to get a permit
from the park district, right?
From the park district,
right.
Yes.
That's not what Biang was in charge of.
Well, what Biang was concerned about is that the protesters, because of the size of the park, because it was a mass rally, because he knew how these towing ordinance protests brought in a lot of people, that he was concerned that it would spill out onto the public, the city.
Right,
is.
I get that.
Yeah,
so
okay,
he
fine.
Did know that it was the park district that gave the permit for the September 4th rally.
Yes, because I think he did, because I think he wanted, Deputy Chief Yancey to find out if he'd gotten a permit from the Park District. I believe that is. I would like to
save some time. All right.
Thank you,
Mr. Flesch. Mr. Cummings.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Your Honors, I'd like to address a couple of points raised by Appellant's counsel here today, and first starting off with Plaintiff Zarita. Counsel has made a string of admissions in his brief and before you here today regarding this claim. And just to be clear, Mr. Zarita had two legal theories that he was proceeding under. The first was a public forum theory, which the district court ruled upon. The second was a retaliation theory, which the district court recognized but explicitly stated in its opinion that it did not need to reach because the public forum theory was valid, and the district court granted summary judgment based on the public forum theory. Counsel has admitted here today that the Waukegan City Council meeting was a public forum, that Mr. Zarita's speech was completely suppressed by Mayor Hyde, that the reason for Mayor Hyde's actions was what Mr. Zarita said to a city employee 2 days earlier, and counsels further admitted that that was not a compelling state interest. And based on those admissions right there, you have a judgment is appropriate in Mr. Zarita's favor. Now, getting to the issue of qualified immunity, it was clearly established in 2004 that when you have a public forum, a public official cannot exclude a person who is eligible to speak at that forum. And in this case, Mr. Zarita was a person at that meeting coming up during audience time who otherwise would have been entitled to speak at that point, unless that public official had a compelling governmental interest to not let that person speak. There was no such interest here, and that was clearly established by the U.S. Supreme Court.
So if he had just criticized him for what he said to the employee 2 days earlier and then let him speak, that would be fine with you.
I would not be standing here right now with respect to Mr. Zarita if that had taken place, but he completely suppressed his speech. Now, we've cited to the court two district court decisions which are the facts couldn't be any closer. In one case, the Williamson case, it was a similar thing. The plaintiff in that case had criticized the city and had some problems with the official who was in charge. The official barred the plaintiff from speaking and made a speech conditional on apology before he could be allowed to speak, just as Mayor Hyde did here. And the court, and that decision was from 1993, I believe it was, said that that was a violation of the First Amendment. Our second case, which has again, virtually identical facts. It's from, like, 1973. So it's long been the law that what happened here was a blatant, obvious violation of the First Amendment. There is no qualified immunity. Now, with respect to Plaintiff Carrasco, what we have here is the application of an assembly ordinance which required a permit and provided for a discretionary fee to be assessed against organizers who wanted to make a public presentation.
And can you clear something up for me, Mr. Cummings? Ms. Carrasco, was it her position that she really wanted, that she had actually planned the protest? I know the testimony is that someone claimed they heard her say she was going to have a rally on that particular day. And did she really plan a protest? What I'm trying to get to is if she really didn't make any attempt to have a rally, should we be here?
Well, what she made very clear was that she planned to come to the city council meeting and to object at the city council meeting to this ordinance. She denied that she was organizing this grand 1,000-person protest that the defendants believed that she was organizing. But as Judge Shader held, the point that the fact that she wasn't actually planning a protest isn't dispositive of this case, because the defendants nonetheless applied this assembly ordinance to her. They sent a police officer to her home, invited her down the city to the police station, into a meeting with three police officers, the police chief, and the city attorney, and made it crystal clear what was expected of her in order to comply with this ordinance for the state. After the meeting, she was sent a letter by the city attorney specifying that they were going to waive the 20-day permit application deadline, but that she was going to have to submit a cash deposit of $1,500, have insurance, which had been specified in a meeting for $1 million, and otherwise she would not be entitled to present this. So they, in fact, did apply this ordinance to her, notwithstanding the fact that she merely planned herself to turn up there and protest. Now,
you're acknowledging that she was not chilled in doing anything that she had a constitutional right to do, i.e. assemble.
Well, no, I'm not acknowledging that, Your Honor. I think the fact that she did show up is not at the city council meeting is not the pertinent question. Is whether a reasonable person could be chilled by what took place with respect to her. And we submit that having a police officer show up at your door and being called down to a meeting with several police officers, a police chief, and being subjected to the application of this ordinance in a way that was unique, the record contains no evidence that on any of the other 500 occasions that this ordinance was theoretically applicable, that the city had ever assessed a cash deposit against anyone other than Ms. Carrasco.
So the standard you're saying we should apply is a reasonable person.
Yes.
And not what her intentions were or what her plan was.
That's right, Your Honor. Otherwise, you could have the most hard-headed protester in the world, and horrendous things could be done to this person that would chill anyone else, but doesn't chill this person. They'd have no claim. It's a reasonable person standard with respect to the chilling. And she did testify that going through this process with respect to their effort to apply this ordinance to her caused her humiliation and emotional distress.
What's his name? Biang? Yeah. What did he do? Because you mentioned the city attorney sent this letter.
Yes. Well, Chief Biang convened the meeting and had the participants come, including the city attorney. So he was the orchestrator of this meeting. He also determined the number of police officers who he believed would be needed to keep the crowd within the boundaries of where the city wanted them to protest. And so his determination of the number of police officers led directly to the calculation of the deposit fee.
By whom?
It was a mechanical process. He said 10 police officers, $50 an hour, 3 hours of time for this protest. So once he determined the number of officers, it was a mechanical calculation to determine the fee.
It's about the city attorney. It's a woman, wasn't it?
Yes.
Was she a defendant or in any way?
No, the city attorney is not a defendant.
Seems to me that she was the major kind of decision maker and assessor of all this.
Well, actually, the 2 points to that. Number one, even though she was responsible in some way, the issue with respect to Chief Bang is whether he had any personal involvement in this process, and he certainly did. He started the whole process off, convened the meeting, determined the number of officers, and he admitted that the number of officers he assigned to this protest was based upon the fact that it was a protest against the city's ordinance. It's also undisputed in this record that Chief Bang disagreed with Ms. Carrasco's view about this seizure ordinance. And he was well aware that she was an opponent of the ordinance. He was a supporter of the ordinance. He assigned more officers to this protest because they were going against the city's ordinance. And he testified he would have had fewer officers if this had been a support protest or a supportive event for the ordinance. So he had a material role in this whole sequence of this effort to apply this ordinance to Ms. Carrasco. So the fact that the city attorney was also involved and sent the letter, she had involvement as well, but our issue is, more than one person could be responsible for this violation, and we would submit that's the case here.
Well, the problem is the $1,500.
Yes, that is one.
I don't care. If we stand around, we're going to do this. It's the money that stopped her.
Well, and she sent, Ms. Carrasco sent back a letter saying there will be no event, and, the thing is, it's a very intimidating prospect, and again, unprecedented, 500 applications of this, and they never assessed a cash deposit, and we have admissions that this was done because this was a protest against the city's ordinance.
Is there any other evidence in the record besides Mr. Biang's directive to Mr. Yancey to, quote, handle the matter that connects Biang to the deprivation of Mr. Blank's constitutional rights?
Well, that's the main piece of evidence, Your Honor. He was also, of course, copied on the letter that was sent to Mr. Blank's, so he was kept fully in the loop of what was going on. And I think, as counsel acknowledged during his argument time, the police chief had thought this through, that even though it was a park district park, he believed that it might lap over into the city, so that he was aware of what was happening here, and the district court found that raised at least an issue of fact as to his personal involvement in this unconstitutional application of the ordinance to Mr. Blanks. Now, Mr. Blanks clearly he canceled his event because he received this letter, which was hand-delivered to him by a police officer, telling him he was in violation of the Waukegan City Ordinance, even though, as Judge Williams, you acknowledged that it didn't apply to an event at this park because that was a park district, which had its own separate ordinance.
Who made that mistake?
Well, again, I believe that letter was drafted by the city attorney and sent to Mr. Blanks. But as far as you get a letter from a city attorney, you're a non-attorney layperson, you're not in a position to know that there may be a mistake here with respect to park district covers the park, city covers the area around the park.
You're not after your city attorney here either.
No, we're not, Your Honor.
Was this happening in 19...
This was 2004, I believe, the events.
What's been going on for the last 8 or 9 years?
Well, this case has been going on for some time. It's been on.
Are people still around?
Our clients?
No, the mayor.
The mayor and the police chief are both are no longer holding those positions.
What's the end result here?
Well, the end result of this case, Your Honor.
Yeah, what's going to happen?
Well, one thing that's happened as a consequence of this case and another case which had been mentioned is these ordinances have been amended to address some of the problems that the people were, our clients were initially protesting with respect to them. And what's going to happen with the rest of this case is after this appeal is decided, we'll go back to the district court and either go to trial or try to see if we can resolve the matter.
People are not going to be enjoying their thought.
Pardon me?
The ordinance has changed, and at least two of the people are gone. They're not there as far as what's the judge do? Are you talking about money?
Well, we're talking about two things. Number one, it is that the finding of the violation of the First Amendment rights of these individuals is extremely important because you have a municipality where there are issues that come up from time to time, and it's important for everyone to know that the First Amendment needs to be respected by this city and others. And number two, there is a damages component to each plaintiff's claim regarding these events. And again, these may not be million-dollar damage claims, and we're not arguing that they are, but certainly, with Ms. Carrasco, for example, having to come to the police station and sit in that meeting and get subjected to this law is something that would cause an ordinary person to experience some emotional distress. So that's an issue as well. Aaron. Now, one final point that I would like to make is there's a suggestion in the appellant's reply brief that under plaintiff's position, even if the protesters had threatened to attack the police and commit acts of law and disorder, illegal conduct, the city would still be required to allow them to have a permit without a fee under plaintiff's position. That's not our position. And those aren't our facts. Political protest is at the heart of the First Amendment, and political protest oftentimes does involve angry protesters. But our clients and all the evidence in the record is the prior protests had been nonviolent, and there was no hint of violence, no threats to attack the police, nothing like counsel placed into his brief. So that doctrine, which might allow the protest not to even have a permit at all, consistent with the First Amendment where there are threats of violence, doesn't apply here. And with that, I see my time has expired. Thank you, Your Honor.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Cummings. How much time?
Let me deal with some of these arguments. With regard to Biang and Blanks, no, he wasn't kept in the loop. He asked Deputy Chief Yancey to handle the matter, and then he got a letter from the city attorney, Gretchen Dedenrip, who is not an attorney. Gretchen Dedenrip testified, and Chief Biang testified. The letter was entirely her creation, entirely her idea. She just copied him because he was a city official. He took no action with regard to the letter. He took no action at all. Blanks never got and never...
You're saying there's no other indication that he was aware of what was going on with respect to the park?
Correct.
Of course, he knew when he was, his whole concern had to do with what might happen at the park and the number of police officers and all that.
And in the record, everyone agrees that the towing ordinance created a lot of anger in the community, and the June 28th protest, the protesters had called the police racists, thieves, scoundrels, and demanded no more towing. And then what is a key point here is, Your Honor asked about was it a planned protest? Did she plan it? Here's what the relevant thing is, that Chief Biang received a memo up the chain of command informing him that her group was planning a protest for July 6th. He knew she planned protests because he had been at several of them and actually had facilitated them. Two, that she had reported to the police officer that you will need, meaning the city will need twice as many officers at the protest that had just occurred, in which they were called all these names, the police officers were, and Biang knew how angry it was. That was the context in which he then asked for the meeting, and he did ask for the meeting, and Carrasco came to the meeting, and it was not unusual for Carrasco and Biang to meet. They had a whole history, and As far as at the meeting being intimidating and so forth, well, at the meeting, Carrasco asked for 10 seats at the city council meeting for herself and her supporters to protest the towing ordinance. And Biang said, fine. In fact, I think Biang may have actually offered that. Now, that occurred at the same meeting in which this, you know, in which he was acting in an allegedly retaliatory or improperly applying the ordinance. And as far as the ordinance is concerned, Chief Biang didn't have anything to do with the ordinance. The police department would file some type of a report, I don't think they ever did, on the different when people applied for a permit. He had no involvement with the ordinance. That was completely the city attorney. He was not involved with the ordinance at all, and as far as the 500 times and all the unique treatment, he knew nothing of that, and he was involved in none of that. So if someone was to blame for that, it was not Chief Biang.
Can I get back to Chief Biang and the park issue? Isn't it correct that the chief was involved in the other matters concerning the ordinance and was aware of the protests that had been planned and was aware also of the discussion of Ms. Carrasco prior to the issue coming up with the other gentleman?
Well, he was aware. It was reported to him that a discussion had occurred between Carrasco and Toro Officer Drexler.
So he had all the background,
yes,
concerning the use of the assembly ordinance when he told his underling to handle the matter, correct?
Well, he knew of the ordinance, and he knew that he knew what he knew from Gretchen Nedenrick bringing the ordinance to the July 6th meeting.
And his underling also knew. The chief was aware of what had happened previously.
There's nothing in the record to that effect. Deputy Chief Yancey was never deposed. There's nothing from him in the record at all.
All right.
Okay. If I could just have a minute on Sarita.
I'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did not say that that Hyde reacted to what was said. What he reacted to was Susanna Figueroa's statement to him afterwards that she felt physically threatened by Sarita. She felt that Sarita was going to hit her. It's conceded that in the Belvedere Mall, it was a very angry crowd. It was overcrowded. It was about the towing ordinance. A lot of people were mad. It was a dangerous situation. This is a garden variety retaliation case. Wilkinson and Smetanka district court cases, they aren't similar facts. Wilkinson was a time, place, manner case, but the defendant didn't disagree with that standard, number one. Number two, you don't have the situation where in the very same meeting a city official allowed the same viewpoint to be expressed. They are distinguishable easily. Collinson Circuit Court case and Hansen is those are the applicable cases here in that regard. One last thing, Judge Shader used the heckler's veto cases like Forsyth County. This was not a heckler's veto case because there's nothing in the record indicating that Biang was concerned about the protester reaction to the protest. Counter-demonstrators, this was about him being reasonably concerned that the protesters themselves might create a threat or harm to public safety, and when people do that, of course they're held responsible for their actions, which means they can be regulated. That's the Cox versus New Hampshire case.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your fine briefs and informative oral argument. We'll take the case under advisement.